This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
There's some amazing and very important material on this story with Yosef and Potiphar's wife that I want to learn with you. There are two main sources that I'm using for this that are quite interesting. There are two Hasidic dynasties. The one is the Sfat Emes, who is the Geira Rebbe. He was the Geira Rebbe the first part of the century. And the Geira Hasidim are very, very important. They are one of the few groups of Hasidim that combine the rigorousness of Lithuanian type of Torah learning with the warmth and mysticism, the Kabbalah of the Hasidic dynasties. And they never compromise the one for the other. And therefore their learning is critically important. The Sfat Emes, interestingly enough, Rebbe Yelofian, my great uncle, went to the Sfat Emes when he was a young man leaving Europe, and he asked him for a brocha, which was interesting because Rebbe Yelofian was the biggest misnagid of the time, probably, which shows you how and what kind of esteem the Geira dynasty was always held until today. It just crossed the boundaries of the Hasidim versus the misnagdim. And the Sfat Emes said to him, a young man who had seen Eliyahu Hanavi doesn't need a blessing from me. That was his answer. Have you heard the story?
No.
You haven't heard the story. So what was Rebbe's answer to that? The only other person who knows that I've seen Eliyahu Hanavi is Eliyahu Hanavi. So if you know that I've seen Eliyahu Hanavi, I need a bracha from you because you've seen him too. And that was the Sfat Emes. And it touches on the point that you made last week, I think, about the codes and the leaving the codes and the code of Torah and where that comes in. And it also touches on the way I dealt in the Monday night show with Abraham bringing his son up as a sacrifice, or nearly bringing his son up as a sacrifice, and the fact that there is a method of accessing the truth that is non-intellectual. The only thing is, you can only get to that when you've gone through a lifetime of the intellectual process. It's not a shortcut. It's a process beyond the intellectual, not instead of the intellectual. And we'll be touching on some of that as well. I'm going to learn various parts of and then we'll link them together. The one thing that he says that our ability to handle the goddess, to handle life outside of Israel, both in Egypt after Joseph's time and throughout the ages, has depended on Yosef. Yosef gave us that power, gave us that ability to deal with that. And he says that Ikar HaGolus Tosefes HaBechiro, the main principle of Golus, the main principle of being in a secular environment outside of Israel. And I think that's really, when we talk about Israel and Golus, we're not talking about two geographic locations. We're talking about a secular environment and an environment of Kedusha, of sanctity. And Golus is living in a secular environment. It doesn't matter whether you're living in Tel Aviv or you're living in Los Angeles. You're living in a secular environment. You're in Golus, wherever that is. And the essence of Golus, he says, is Tosefes HaBechiro, is additional choice. It's just the exponential expansion of choice. And the work of the geula, of the godless is a chesedchin lotzeis me'abechirazu ha'geula hashlema. And true redemption is the ability to handle that choice and come out from it and emerge from it, from having handled choice. And that Yosef introduces here for the first time. Yosef has the first time that Yosef is proposed total freedom of choice. Everybody's out of the house. There's nobody there. He's attracted to her, she's attracted to him, he's reasoned it, he's free to make his own choice, there's nobody there. The handling of that choice was a critical instrument for our capacity to handle the Golus ever since then, to handle choice, to learn how to handle choice. So this whole interaction between him and her becomes important in our understanding of choice and how to deal with it. The next thing he says is Vayema'en, when the Torah tells us that he refused. Interesting also, by the way, is on the sequence of things, is at what point did she start becoming attracted to him? It says that Yosef was very charismatic and very beautiful, and it was after these things, but it says, Vayehi achar ha-devorim o'el, it was after these things, this is in chapter 39, verse 7, it was after these things that Batiso Eshes Adino Veseno Yosef, that his master's wife, started noticing Yosef, and she proposed what she did to him. After what things? What is it that brought that about? It doesn't say, and it was because he was attractive. Then it would just say, Vayehi Yosef Yafei Tzar, Yafei Mar, Yosef was very attractive and very charismatic. But he saw his other novice, and his master's wife noticed him and started communicating with him. It doesn't say that. It adds, after telling us that he was attractive, it says, Vayehi achar hadvorim o'el. It was after these things that she began to notice him and to talk to him. What were the things? Immediately before that, absolutely right. You don't even have a commission, you know that. You're absolutely right. But right before that, that God had blessed him, and whatever he touched was successful. Vayazov chalashalo biyad Yosef. And he left everything that he had in the hands of Yosef. What was it that gave him that charisma in her eyes? She didn't notice him when he was a little slave boy from Israel. When he became the general manager of her husband's empire, all of a sudden he became attractive. Realize what we do when we don't encourage our sons to make it. I'm not saying that is the only reason to be attractive. There are lots of attractive things about people. But let us not underestimate the attractiveness, even in the man-woman relationship, that rests on success. And as long as it's success in something that she values, if she really values Torah more than anything else, and he's successful in Torah and he's never made it in business or in professions, that's fine. If that's truly what she values above all else, but if she truly values money, just she says she values Torah, then there's going to be marital problems if he's only been to Kollel and hasn't made it in business. Terribly important to find out what she really values, because he'd better be good at what she really values. If he's not good at what she really values, there's no way that they can make it. And we see that over here, that Potiphar's wife saw astrologically that there was meant to be a connection, and we'll discuss that too. But she only began to see that, she only began to consult the astrologist after she noticed that this was somebody exceptional, this was somebody successful, this was somebody with power. Now, after she appealed to him, he goes through the whole argument about why not. Before he goes to the argument, the first thing is, she says, sleep with me, vayema'en. He refused. Then it says, and he said to the wife of his master, "Hey, my master doesn't know what goes on in the house." But first he refused. The order is wrong. It should say, and he said, he argued it through, and at the end of that he said, and therefore the answer is no. It's wrong. He starts with his vayomer. The answer is no. And then he said to her, now let's talk it through. Let's figure out why the answer is no. And he goes through the process. Why that process? Says the Gary River, the following was Sasemis. Vayema'en, when it says that he refused, that was belina tinas tam, that was without reasoning. That was no. Ba'al yedei yira shemaim zu, and through this yira shemaim, he terms this yira shemaim, the capacity to say no before you reason. Why are you saying no? Because you're scared. What are you scared of? Hashem. Zochin achar kach linso tamim livchor b'tov v'limas bara. Afterwards, you find the reasons to choose the good and reject the bad. I'm going to read what he says. It sounds extreme, but we're going to analyze it very deeply. Ki chokhmat ha'odom hevel, because man's intellect is nonsensical, not nonsensical, is void, it's invalid. Uvo al yodoli de toret, and one makes mistakes using it. And what is he saying? Therefore, be irrational. We'll see what he means. The wisdom that comes through Yira Shemaim is the truth. Now, that means that there are, he's defining, as does King Solomon define. King Solomon says, Reshis Chochmo Yira Hashem, the beginning of wisdom is the fear of God. And that's a funny thing. I can understand the beginning of ethics is the fear of God. The beginning of morality is the good of, is the fear of God. The beginning of a value system is the fear of God. What is the beginning of wisdom is the fear of God? Fear of God should be the end of wisdom. If you're just scared of God and you don't do anything, why do you need wisdom? What is the relationship between Yirah Shemayim and wisdom? And yet Mishlei says, King Solomon says, the beginning of wisdom is the fear of God. And he says, the Sfas Emes is saying, clearly building on that same concept, that the wisdom that one generates oneself is fallacious, it can lead one to error. The wisdom of truth is the wisdom that emanates from Yirah Shemayim. Now what does that mean? There's another Hasidic dynasty, the Sokhachova dynasty, also very, very amazing, also have made their mark both in the rational area of Lithuanian learning and in the mysticism of Kabbalah. And I'm going to read a part of him to you because he touches and builds on the same idea. V'zeh limud godol l'chol ish. This is something every person should learn from. V'hagia shumaisa shu b'tiro itachas yodah. When something improper comes his way, lo yidche ha'dorah b'tan asichlis. Don't start using reason. Don't start rationalizing. Don't start reasoning with it. Sha'seichel einenu bahir. U'me'ir tomi l'negedenu. Because seichel is not always clear and doesn't always clarify. We see very clearly that bright people are swayed by bribery. And if one's mind was so clear, why would you be swayed by bribery? Why can a little bribe, and we see sometimes a very small bribe, can cause one to see things in a funny way. The biggest bribery is the desire to want something. By the way, Yosef, if you look at Yosef, he also saw with astrology and shalal. She saw with astrology, which was her most scientific way of figuring out what should I do. So she consulted her astrologist and said, "Look, there's this," he said, "leave my own desire out of it. What's up with this man? There's a man in my life. He works for my husband, and I'm crazy about him. What is he?" Astrologist looks at the stars and says, "You're meant to have a child together." That's interesting. Umistomegam Yosef lo. Yosef was also able to see, using his mystical connections, his Kabbalah and astrology, he must have been able to see the same. And the reasoning process must have argued that this Avera was in fact a mitzvah. Must have gone through that, otherwise why would he have gone through all this reason? Why was he even grappling with it? The issue that he must have been grappling with is maybe this wrongdoing was in fact a mitzvah. And if he would have refused using logic, there wouldn't have been a refusal. the logic would have persuaded him that he doesn't really owe it, and she doesn't like her husband in any case, and she's non-Jewish, and they're not properly married according to halacha, and they're meant to have a child together, and he would have reasoned and rationalized the whole thing through as she did. So what are they saying? Therefore don't reason, therefore don't rationalize. I mentioned on Monday night that there are three types of knowledge that we talk about. Chokhmah, Bina, and Das. That's what Chabad stands for. Chokhmah, Bina, and Das. Chokhmah is a body of knowledge outside of ourselves, which is the Torah and everything that comes with it, or science, whatever, body of knowledge outside. Bina is our reasoning, our extrapolation from that body of knowledge, so we can innovate, taking that body of knowledge and applying our reasoning, we can extrapolate and create new ideas. But what is that new idea that we have innovated? Is that internal or external to us? No, still external, because you've taken a body of knowledge that's outside of you and you've used logic to deduce something which is still, it's true, you've done it with your own thinking, but at the end of the day you've used your thinking to create something outside of you. It's like baking a cake. At the end of the day, yes, it's your recipe and it's your putting it all together, but the cake is outside of you. You've used something of yourself to create something outside of you using materials that is outside of you. But then there is Das. Das is something inside. Das is a knowledge that doesn't reside outside of you. It resides inside.
Once you
There's belonging, but the mere fact that the mere concept of belonging implies outside of you. If there's a need to own, it's outside of you. Otherwise, you don't own you. You are you. So there are things which are you, and there are things which you own, and there are things which are not yours at all, which are somebody else's. They're just different levels of outside of you. But ownership in itself defines an external relationship. You only own things that are outside of you. That's why in the Eastern religions they banish ownership, because they're trying to deal with the internal. If it's ownership implies it's outside of you, and you shouldn't have to build your self-esteem through things that are outside of you. It should be all the internal. So ownership is an external thing. But that, we'll see, that is more than common sense. It's deeper than common sense. No, you've got it.
You can't acquire it. No.
Yes, you cannot acquire it. You can access it. Everybody's got it in different measures. You can, maybe at a very young age, while you're being raised as a child, you can be helped to bear. But it's really you accessing it. You're not acquiring it. It's there. You access it. The external you acquire, the internal you access. Now, in the fear of subjectivity, there is an enormous tendency, both in the scientific world, in the quantitative world, and in the new religious world, to deny the value of the internal. Because that's dangerous. Now, here you have, I don't even know if this should be on a tape, because here you have probably the deepest understanding of the difference between the Hasidim and the Mishnagdim. And one has to question whether in our time there's not a whole lot that we need to be learning from the Hasidim. Because the Mishnagdim were so fearful, the Muslim movement was so fearful of subjectivity that they placed all of their emphasis on objectivity. Figure it out, work it out, it's either right or it's wrong, check the halacha. The Hasidim, you can see it coming through here, are so worried that you can twist the halacha, that you can twist the reason, that they try and get people to access what's inside them, and they think that's safer. Now, I've never heard the difference between Hasidim and Mishnagdim explained that way, but I believe that's the essential difference. That the Hasidim feared that there could be distortion of the external, and the Mishnagdim feared there could be distortion of the internal. And of course both are right and both are wrong. There's the possibility of both. But here in these two Hasidic masters, you see them both working along the line of, if Yosef would have used halacha, if he would have used critical analysis, he would have had the relationship. What kept him out of it was vayema'en, no reason. Just something inside me says it's wrong. But we go much further than this. And this really is firstly, the whole Torah background, not the whole, but it's part of the Torah background for our culture, values, ethics module, and it leads in now to a new, very, very troubling development on that model. On that model. And that is, there are actions, the things we do. There are the things we believe. The things we believe are the internal things. That's where it should reside. Our belief should be not something we were taught. Our belief should not be something we read about, we learnt about. That's why it's crazy for a Jew to go to Buddhism or to Islam or to Hinduism. You can't get belief from somewhere else. You better access what's in here, what comes, what you were born with, what you were given through generations and generations of genetic development, both in the soul and in the body. Deep inside here, that's what you want to try and access. That's where one's beliefs should be. And we'll see in a moment where Yosef's beliefs came from. And when he says, do it because of Yerushalayim, what is he saying? Don't work out what's right and what's wrong logically. Access your belief system and you'll find that it's wrong. That she's a married woman, you're a trusted servant, and it's wrong. Finished. There's nothing more to discuss. That's a belief. When you start analyzing it, you can analyze it to death until you've analyzed it away and it doesn't exist anymore. What are we saying? If you take a person, his belief system, and his actions. Now, one of the things we do in our work is we examine why people's actions and belief systems are usually out of sync. People very seldom act the way they believe. Sometimes they're completely out of sync, sometimes they're a little bit, but generally people believe better things than they act. People are better in their beliefs than they are in their actions, isn't that so? Most people, except angels. Where is the thinking process? Where is the intellectual process? What is it attached to? Does the intellectual process drive your beliefs, or does the intellectual process drive your actions? What would you say? The actions. Your beliefs have to come from somewhere else. Otherwise, they're not beliefs. They're philosophies. If you've reasoned your beliefs, they're not beliefs. If they're deep inside you and they come from somewhere, from inside, then they're beliefs. If you've reasoned them out and worked them out or read them in a book, they're not beliefs. That's acquired knowledge. That's chokhmah. We want to find belief in the da'at realm. So if you say, how do you know about it? Well, I've learnt it. If you've learnt it, it's not da'at. If you've learnt it, it's chokhmah. And belief has to be in the da'at area. But what about intellectual process? We said intellectual process drives the action rather than the belief. What we're finding here, in fact, is that the intellectual process sometimes drives the action, but sometimes the intellectual process justifies the action. In other words, the action drives the intellectual process. So if you take if you access your inner belief and you can translate that into an action, then your intellectual system will link back to your beliefs. Because in justifying your action, it will explain your belief. But if your action is off sync from your belief, what is your intellectual process going to do? It's not going to say you're a dishonest so-and-so. Your intellectual process is going to need to find reason for the action. And it simply severs the action still more from the belief process. And so the Sfas Emes and the Shem Mishwur are dealing with Yosef having gone through, as Abraham did, a lifetime of learning and intellectual analysis and understanding of the Torah. We're not talking about a person coming off the street and being told, just believe, we're not talking about that at all. These are people who've learned Gemara, who've learned to know, who have mastered all the intellectual material there is to master about Torah. Now the question is, what do I use? Having mastered all that, there's a beautiful woman who wants to have a relationship with me. What am I going to use to deal with this dilemma? Am I going to use all the knowledge I've developed? Or am I going to use something inside me? We see from Vayimayin. And if you look, those of you who are Chumash, what's after the Vayimayin? Can you see something immediately after the Vayimayin? A line. A break. Vayimayin. Stop. Break. The answer is no. Why? Because it doesn't feel right. Now let's start reasoning. Let's start figuring out. Now what is my intellect going to do? Why doesn't it feel right? The other way is, what should I do? Should I do A or should I do B? Let me start reasoning. You can go anywhere you want. You'll find reasoning. You can reason either way. Reasoning will not necessarily get you to truth. Reasoning will get you to a more expedient option, to a better option. If you're looking at calculative things, if you're looking, should I invest in A or should I invest in B? You can reason. Should I pursue this or should I pursue that? Should I spend my time on this? Those are all things. Reason can help you measure. But reason can't access something that's deep inside you. Yosef starts off accessing that, which they call the Yirat Shamayim, that direct relationship with God, that soul relationship. My soul says it's wrong. Now let's figure out. The difficulty is, astrology says it's right. So all the spiritual forces are saying it's right. And here we get the conflict between spirituality and morality. Spirituality is not necessarily moral. We've often said Avodah Zarah, idolatry, is spiritual. We're not suggesting that idol worship is not spiritual. Why would people do it if it wasn't spiritual? It is spiritual. Astrology is spiritual. Mysticism is spiritual. All these things are spiritual. It doesn't mean that they are tools to lead you to the right solution. That spirituality can lead you to murder as well. Spirituality can lead you to wrong things. They can lead you to destructive things. So spirituality, the spiritual force, both in her and in him, said get together. The rational force said get together. Why? Because they wanted to, and the rational will justify. The only thing that Yosef could access that wasn't that way was to access something deep inside me, to be able to get to the essence. What does my soul say about it? Not my head. What is my soul saying about it? And my soul says via my soul says no. Now, just before we take a question, I'm going to learn two more brief pieces with you, and then we'll string it together. What about she grabs his garment? So again, it's Fasa Emes. It's Chalilo Shebe Emes Ratzalachtot. Clearly, Yosef didn't come into the house planning to sin. That isn't what was going on. This man was incredibly great. He says, but in a person's being, there are different layers. And some of the external layers have an attachment to the Yetzer Hara, to the forces of evil. The very deep parts don't. You remember my talk on Rosh Hashanah, that when you access that there is a deep part of you that has a right to chastise you because it's untouched, it's pure. But as you move outward, as you become more superficial, you're dealing with things that have more attachment to the physical world, and therefore more attachment also to the potential of doing wrong. Yaakov gives Yosef a precious coat. What is the meaning of that coat? In other words, Yosef is being defined, differentiated by a certain status conferred upon him from where? Outside. So his coat is given to him by his father. It's an external status conferred on him. What happens to that coat? No, before.
The brothers
strip it off him and throw him into the pit. So his external differentiation, and they track that experience was critical for him to be able to handle this experience. Because that was saying to him, what he had to cope with then is, who am I without my coat? Who am I in a pit of scorpions? Who am I without my father's blessing? Without my father's status? Without my father's authority? I'm just here, and then in Egypt, as a slave boy. I was talking to another ex-South African last night, and we were comparing some notes that were quite interesting, because his father in a different field was at least as famous as my father was in his field. His father was probably a lot more so. And he was talking about what it was like to come to a country where, when you say your last name, people say, how do you spell that? Whereas he was in a country where people would say your last name and say, yes sir, you know, please, come this way, what can I do for you? You didn't have to do anything to deserve it. That was just because he happened to have the right last name. What Yosef had to do, and we were talking about the fact that that's the hardest part of emigration. And it's, you know, getting your papers and your bank accounts and finding a business, all the easy stuff. One of the hardest parts is stripping yourself of all the things that you've taken for granted, which are not really you. But that's the way you're seen, it's the coat of many colors. So Yosef walks around with this beautiful uniform. And what does it say to people? I'm special, I'm different, I'm my father's heir. That gives him an incredible advantage. He had to cope with losing that before he could become anything. So he had to go through that process of the brothers stripping it off and tearing it up and dipping it in blood and throwing him away and selling him as a slave. And now he's in Egypt without his coat. And now he develops a new coat. Again, he's got status. Now his master has given him status again, Mr. Yosef, great Yosef. Who is this great Yosef? He's the general manager of Potiphar's household. Potiphar's one level below Paro. Mr. Yosef is on the upper echelons of Egyptian society, expressed in his coat. What happens again? She links onto the coat. And he says, if you love my coat, take it. That's not me. And he leaves his coat in her hand. And off he goes, once again, trying to access the me. Had he worked with his externals, he would have given himself to her. He would have entered that relationship. He had to leave the coat in her hands and re-access and rediscover who he really is. Ki vadai, says the Gerei Rebbe, kol nisayon, who every trial is, kishenot lim adam madrekatam yuchedis, happens when your differentiation is removed from you. And then you've got to rediscover your own differentiation on a still deeper level. V'chein begolus niton imenu, that's what golus is. Hatsiyu v'amal b'sham yuchud lonu be'etz Yisrael, we as the Jewish people, when we were in our own land, with our own king, and our own legal system, and our own political system, we had a certain status. Now you come into Europe or into America and you're a Jew. It's not a particularly complimentary thing to be. You're not differentiated out of your greatness. That's what Golus is. Golus is Yosef's experience in Egypt. Golus is emigration. Golus is coming to a new place where the externals are not recognized. They're unimportant. They don't count. So what does he use to access? I'm switching now to the Sokhachev Rebbe again. Sokhachev Rebbe says, they all grapple with this. Could Yosef really have come into this house to have an affair with this woman? It just doesn't fit. It doesn't make sense in terms of who Yosef was and who Yosef became. And he says, clearly, the same as with Yehuda. It doesn't make sense that Yehuda and these two stories are juxtaposed so beautifully and so critically for many reasons. And one of them is that Yehuda also doesn't make sense that a man of Yehuda's stature would have gone off wandering into the red light district. And why? That just doesn't begin to make any sense. And Chazal say, you remember there, that there was an angel that pushed him into it. Not meaning that he wasn't responsible, but just he was overcome with an enormous force. Passion. There is an angel. There is a force of passion in Shemayim, in God's heaven. There is the power of passion, and we've discussed it and why it's important and how it has to be incorporated. But there was almost a spiritual force that brought such intensity of passion in Yehuda that was what he did. So here says the Shem Yishmur clearly that Yosef was, there was this, that same kind of passion was introduced. What's interesting is, which human being has fought spiritual forces and won? Yaakov. That was Yaakov's gift to us. Yaakov gets into battle with the power of Esav. The power of Esav is raw passion. I remember Esav, the one who used to hunt women and had all these crazy incestuous relationships and landed up with Amalek. Esav is just passion with no morality. Raw passion. He has a soul. He has an angel. That is a spiritual force. It's not just an Esav. Yaakov, the human being, encounters the spiritual form, the angel of Esav, and they battle. And Yaakov gets wounded in the battle, but not killed. He wins the battle. And what does the angel say to him afterwards? He doesn't say, you fought with the devil and won. What does he say? You have fought with God and you have won. And that's why his name is Yisrael. That's what our name means. Yisrael means we've battled with God. That doesn't mean God for good. It means the passionate part of God, that we can engage with that battle, deal with that passion, we know how to handle it. And Yosef, now in order to access the deepest part of him, where does he go? Yeah, that's it last week. Image of his father. Who's his father? The one who beat the angel of Esau. At the end of the day, I have it within me to look this passion in the face, to access my soul, and to say, yes, there is a place for passion, but not in this relationship. This is not where it's meant to be. Reason, astrology, all the rest of it. Care. But my soul says no. My soul says this is not the place for it. There's a better place for it. This is not the place for it. The Rabbi Yerucham, who was the Mashgiach in Mir Yeshiva, for reasons of just sort of after the wartime, just immediately after the war, Rabbi Yerucham makes a beautiful comment again in the comparison between the two stories of Yehuda and Yosef. Both women did it for good reason. Both women knew that it was meant to be. yet she becomes a villain and Tamar becomes a heroine. Why? What's the difference between them? I'm not going to give this one away to you. You must figure this one out. What's the difference between them? It's critical. She becomes the villain and she becomes the hero, and they did the same thing for the same reason. True, Tamar wasn't married and all that, but she kind of was because she was waiting for Gibel and so on. Leaving that part aside of it, their intentions were the same, and yet Tamar becomes a hero and the wife of Potiphar becomes a villain. And she knew that she had to be the mother of the of Mashiach ben Yosef.
Potiphar's
wife.
Potiphar's wife is not Jewish, and so isn't there something where the non-Jews are ruled by the stars, but the Jews have the ability to go above the stars? So
yeah, we'll see what happens with the astrology. But she was right about the astrology. The fact is, Yosef married her daughter. So all she knew is that there had to be a marriage here. It didn't enter her mind that it was her daughter. So she made an error there. The error is not the issue. The issue is in how they handled it. Where is the big difference in how they handled it? No. See, the one used seduction, either tried with seduction. You're right, she became a little bit more forceful, which was her downfall. But she, but that wasn't the differentiation.
Tamar did it in a public way.
Yes, and this comment between Yehuda and Yosef and the Kiddush Hashem that they both bring about, but that's a different area. That's not the difference in the women so much. It's a real difference. Like, that's it. It's what they did to save themselves afterwards, when it was about to become public knowledge. Both of them did something private, which then were about to be exposed. What does Tamar do? You decide what to do with it. I will never expose you. What does Potiphar's wife do? She starts screaming, she calls the press in, she calls the police, she gets it immediately. There you have the difference. The way the ultimate part is handled reflects back on the original, on the purity of original intention. If her intentions were so pure that she thought he was so, if she was after more than his status, if she was after more than his cloak, she would never have done that. That reveals retrospectively that although astrology and all this, that what she was really turned on by was his charm and his status, not his sanctity. She was not really accessing his sanctity, and that's why he leaves his coat in her hands. The exit as far as Yosef is concerned is the accessing of himself. And when we said where does a person get that from, can one acquire it? Yes, one acquires it from one's parents. Whether that acquisition from parents is genetic or whether it's upbringing, it's probably both. It's probably there, and the soul acquires it in a kind of spiritual gene process. But unless the parent brings it out from the child through upbringing in the early years, it doesn't actually come. And there was a very interesting study done here very recently about what was common about those families that produced great people. And they were talking about great people not just to achieve greatness, but great moral people who had moral certainty, moral clarity. And it was an amazing study, and they found the only common denominator they could find was, number one, that the family had dinner together every night and were quite particular about that, but more important than that, a lot of the families that have dinner that don't develop those kind of children, is what they discussed. And what they discussed at dinner was the morality of various different actions. Something that happened in the newspaper, something happened at work, something happened at school. The discussion would be, is that right or wrong? Is what happened right or wrong? But the study went one step further, and religious people said, oh, that's the secularist, and I got very excited with the study. The study went one step further and said, there was no common area of religion. So it was across the religion that there was no difference between any one religion and any other, and it applied equally with secularists who had no religion. This had nothing to do with religion. And that's incredibly interesting, because what is the debate then around the table? Is this right or is it wrong? What's the debate at a very often at a frum family on Friday night? What are we talking about? Is it halacha, isn't it? Is it allowed or is it not allowed? There's a big difference between is it allowed or isn't it allowed, is it right or is it wrong. Not so much the difference in conclusion, but the difference in process. If you're discussing whether it's right or it's wrong, you're teaching the child to access that something deep inside them. If you're talking about whether it's halakhic or not, you're teaching him analysis. Important to teach it, nothing wrong with that, but that's not the thing that does it. The thing that does it at the end of the day is being able to access that inner sense of what's right or what's wrong, because the child will rationalize anything later on using that same halakhic process that you taught him to justify all sorts of deviant things. If the child wants to do that, at the end of the day there's a need to access that within themselves. What happened with all this astrology if they were meant to get together? Yosef landed up marrying her daughter. Who was her daughter? Dina. Her daughter was his sister.
So her daughter was Dina?
Her daughter was Dina.
Was Dina,
according to most views, was Dina herself. After the rape of Dina, Dina went off to Mitzrayim, and she carried around with her a piece of parchment written and signed by Yaakov that whoever marries this girl is marrying into the home of Yaakov, into the home of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. So that no matter where she went and what would happen, she would always have that with her. And imagine when she meets Yosef. Nobody knows that Yosef is anything other than a slave. Nobody knew who he was. She meets Yosef at all places in Potiphar's house. And all that Potiphar's wife knew was that her daughter, her adopted daughter, because Dina was then adopted by Potiphar. So there must have been something potentially great in the Potiphar's and Mr. and Mrs. Potiphar, that they noticed something in Dina and they adopted her, that they noticed something in Yosef and gave him that power. There must have been the potential in them to become very great. It never got realized. And we see in her behavior and in his behavior later on why it never got realized. The self-interest, the self-protection, rather than accessing the truth, rather than getting to the truth. As close as they come to being able to appreciate greatness, they never quite make it. But Yosef and later on Osnat, Bat Potiphar, her name then changed to Osnat, establish a home in Mitzrayim and raise two sons who, despite the fact that they have no culture, no society, because of the input they got from their home, were able to be Ephraim and Menashe, the same Ephraim and Menashe that parents every Friday night bless their son. And may you become like Ephraim and Menashe. When we bless a girl, what do we say? May you become like Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. When we bless a boy, we don't say like Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. We say, may you become like Ephraim and Menashe. Because Ephraim and Menashe were out there. The girls, hopefully, will be in a protected environment, certainly in the traditional Jewish framework, so they need to become like Avraham, Yitzchak, like a Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. Let the boys go out into the world. And one wants the boys to be able to go out into the world and function and yet be an Ephraim and a Menashe. But that, when the father gives that blessing to his sons, what he should be thinking of, what did Yosef and Osnat have to invest in Ephraim and Menashe to make sure that they remained Ephraim and Menashe within the Egyptian culture. And that's where we leave the book of Bereishit, and we get onto the book of Shemot next.